Welcome to 4truth.net, the Ministry of the Apologetics and Interfaith Evangelism Department of the North American Mission Board. I'm Rob Bowman, manager of that department, and I'm joined by telephone today by Craig Hawkins. Craig is a Christian apologist of many years' experience and done a lot of research into a variety of subjects in apologetics, not just the topic of our conversation today. But I've asked Craig to spend some time with us to talk about a wide array of topics that go under the names of the occult, but also really focusing especially on neo-paganism, witchcraft, Wicca, and subjects related to those terms that many people throw around in our culture today, but very few really understand. Craig is the author of a couple of books that I want everybody to know about. He is an accomplished author on these subjects. One of these books is called Goddess Worship, Witchcraft, and Neo-Paganism. That's Goddess Worship, Witchcraft, and Neo-Paganism. And that's published by Zondervan. And then he's also written a book called Witchcraft, Exploring the World of Wicca. And again, his name is Craig Hawkins, H-A-W-K-I-N-S, and you can find those books at Amazon.com or various other places, I'm sure, and I encourage those who are interested in these subjects, whether they are Christians looking for information to be able to share the gospel with people in these movements, or if you are in one of these movements and you're interested in an intelligent Christian perspective on your beliefs and what somebody like Craig would say about them, then I would encourage you to take a look at these books. Craig, thanks for joining me on 4truth.net.
Oh, Rob, my pleasure.
Craig, tell us a little bit about yourself, your the ministries that you're involved with in apologetics, anything you'd like to share with us.
Sure, great. I'm an adjunct professor at Trinity Graduate School, the California campus. I've been teaching there basically since 1989. I've taught on and off at Biola University in the Christian Apologetics Department for about 10 years as well. And I host a radio program, among other things. It's called Living by the Word. We're on the radio. It's on Sunday nights from 10 to 12 specific time. But more importantly, we're actually on the World Wide Web, the Internet, via his channel, hischannel.com or .org. Either way, we'll get you there. And it's rebroadcast about three or four times during the week, so you can see the broadcast. It's a live question and answer time where we take various questions relative to a lot of the topics you've mentioned, Rob, and then cults, the occult, philosophy, philosophical, religion, and so forth, theology, Bible difficulties, a number of topics. And then I'm also starting a regular teaching program, kind of a seminary on the Internet program, where we teach classes on things like Christology and other the study of Christ and major topics. Also, I head up a ministry called AIM, Apologetics Information Ministry, and we have a website, Apologetics Info, just one word, apologeticsinfo.org is the address or URL, and we have a lot of free literature that's available for people to read and download and so forth.
Well, that's terrific, and I encourage people to check out your website. Again, that's apologeticsinfo.org, and one of the nice things about Craig's website is that he doesn't just have little articles with his own opinions, but he also he gives very detailed bibliographies on various subjects so that if you want to do further reading on particular topics in apologetics, you have a place to go to get some recommendations of things to read. And the various resources, outlines covering various topics in apologetics, so I encourage people to check out apologeticsinfo.org. Now, Craig, let's talk about the occult, which is sort of the big category, perhaps, within which we might talk about some other subjects, or at least overlapping with some of the things that we're going to spend most of our time talking about. That word occult, O-C-C-U-L-T, sometimes gets confused with the word cult, especially when people say a cult. It sounds almost exactly the same, so could you explain for us what's the difference between a cult, C-U-L-T, and what is called the occult, O-C-C-U-L-T?
Sure, Rob. Great question. Cult comes from the Latin cultus and originally meant the sect or division of a larger religion. Christianity, in that sense, was considered a cult of Judaism. It wasn't a derogatory term, it was simply a descriptive term. Now, the word cult has at least six or seven major definitions. However, as I'm using it, the word cult, C-U-L-T, simply is a group, a religion, or a group of people who claim to be Christian. In fact, they generally claim to be the only true Christians, yet they deny one or more essential Christian doctrines. So, take Jehovah's Witnesses. They deny not only salvation by grace alone through faith alone, the unique deity of Christ, the bodily resurrection. There's an example. Again, they claim to be Christian. In fact, the only true Christians, but really deny essential Christian doctrines. Now, the occult, on the other hand, they also almost always, if not always indeed, deny essential Christian doctrines. But the key difference is they're also involved in the big three categories. That is divination and or sorcery or magic. I'll use those terms interchangeably. They're different terms in Greek and Hebrew, but they have enough overlap for us to use them as synonymous. And then spiritism. So groups like this would be everything from ritual magic to witchcraft to palm readers to tarot card readers, what have you. All, that whole group, so-called psychics, that is the kingdom of the occult. And it's, the occult is a general title, and then there's many subgroups underneath it. But what they all have in common is they're all involved in some way, shape, or form in, again, spiritism and or divination and or magic slash sorcery.
Now, would it be fair or at least roughly accurate to say that that what you're calling the occult is often called something like the paranormal? What's the relationship between occultism and the paranormal?
Really the same thing. There are some Christians who believe that originally Adam and Eve might have had some paranormal abilities, and that may or may not be true, but it's so fraught today with difficulties because of the landmine field of the occult. So generally, though, yes, the paranormal often is just simply a synonym for the occult.
So in other words, when people are getting involved in the occult, they're very often pursuing powers or experiences that are very often labeled paranormal because they go beyond the normal experience in our day-to-day physical world.
Right, kind of like the idea of the sixth sense, if you will. Think of Duke University that's actually had a department for paranormal studies. Paranormal has more respectability to it. It sounds scientific.
Right.
But what people need to understand is even many occultists today don't like the term, for example, supernatural. They like the term supernormal or paranatural. They use the same terminology. They believe the occult is often super science. And it's just simply the avant-garde science. So really the terms exactly are interchangeable.
Now, I have a question about the interest that many people have in the occult today. A lot of times when Christians talk about occultism, they are talking about the pursuit of experiences that they regard as coming directly from demonic influence. In other words, the occult is understood to be, from many Christians' point of view, really an activity of Satan and the demons. And whenever people are fooling around with Ouija boards or tarot cards or tea leaves or whatever, they're coming into contact with the demonic. Could you address that? Would that be accurate? Is it perhaps an overgeneralization, or is that pretty accurate?
Well, I think it's a fair generalization that the occult is a doorway to the demonic, and people must understand this. Biblically speaking, it's whether they know it or not. That people may not be trying to get pregnant, but if they're doing things that lead to that, that's what happens.
Nice analogy.
Yeah. The person who's playing Russian roulette may not mean to kill themselves, but that's not uncommon that it happens because that's what goes with the territory. So the biblical view is that ultimately one is opening door to the demonic. However, having said that, it doesn't mean that every time someone does something in the domain of, again, the occult, and think of that again as spiritism, divination, magic slash sorcery, that they're always getting the demonic on the line. There are some times where people, we would call it auto-suggestion. People have heard if you do this, if you play the Ouija board, something's going to speak to you or start moving the device and so forth. And sometimes it's self-fulfilling. They start doing it themselves. At some level, conscious or unconscious, subconscious, they start doing it themselves. So I don't believe every alleged instance of some activity is necessarily demonic. I believe you're in that realm, but it can be auto-suggestion. And there's also a heterosuggestion. Again, either one is prompting oneself, whether they know it or not, or they've heard actually from someone else. Do this, you're going to get that. And so they do it and go, wow, it really does work. When in fact, it's really just a form of some type of mental activity on their own part at some level. So I don't want to jump to everything. Therefore, that happens is demonic.
Now, could you then address the question of what really Satan and the demons are able to do? Are they able to do things that we would describe as miracles? Are demons able to heal people? Are they able to do things like levitation and so forth? Or is much of this sort of overhyped or not really something that occurs?
Rob, there are theologians, at least, are split on the matter. Some theologians, I think of R.C. Sproul, for example, and I believe Norman Geitzer is in the same category, they would argue that all alleged, and I'll use the term supernatural activity, is merely a form of prestidigitation or of sleight of hand. It's really an illusion or delusion. It appears that they can do that, but in fact they can never do that. The idea is that the demonic can never really intervene, Satan or the demonic realm, into our world, the time-space continuum. So they'd say, so it's trickery. It's snake oil. It's never actual intervention. Now, others like myself, I believe, not always, just because somebody says something happened, I don't just jump to the conclusion, oh, they did. But if I believe if there's sufficient evidence for it, and I believe there are cases where the demonic does actually intervene. I think of, I'll use the example at least of Job chapter 1 and chapter 2. It appears that God, when God allows it, that the evil one can actually intervene. I would argue as well, for example, the key passage in Thessalonians that talks about lying, signs and wonders and so forth, that it's not just that they're lying, that is, they're apparent signs or wonders, but they are literal signs and wonders, but their purpose is to deceive people, is to lead them astray. Furthermore, I would argue in the book of Revelation chapter 13 and elsewhere, part of the evil one's deception, and I would argue of the Antichrist and the false prophet, is that they are able to do these lying signs and wonders, even, it appears, calling down fire from heaven and so forth. And so, again, the debate is among theologians, can they directly intervene or not? Whatever the case is, and I argue for the latter, I want to point out just two things, though, nonetheless. So in other words, even if somebody's able to do something that's what I would call supernatural, I don't just say, therefore, it must be of God. Because we're warned even clear back in Deuteronomy 13 and chapter 18, it's not just if somebody can do something, it's if it's in accord with sound doctrine and teaching. So I don't believe this really denies the sovereignty of God if God allows the demonic or the evil one to do things like that under certain context. I think God's still in control. But the key is whether he literally does it or just appears to do it is how you know whether it's of God or not is according to the teaching that will go with it. What is the person proposing? What are they saying about life, the meaning and purpose of life, and about God and salvation?
So these things may occur, and again, as you said, Christian theologians have somewhat differing views on what kinds of powers the demons are actually able to wield and what they're actually able to accomplish, but we still have a responsibility to test these by comparing what the interpretation of these, what significance they're supposedly carrying with what the Bible says. Now, let me ask you this. Assuming for the sake of argument that demons are able to do some things that intervene into our physical universe and cause supernatural events to occur here in our space-time universe, would it still be fair to say, perhaps, that there are certain things that God can do in our world in terms of the miraculous that they cannot do?
Yes, great point. Great way to say that. I think of Moses, for example, and his confrontation with the Egyptian occultists. I would argue it appears that they were able to do something, again, whether it was just superficially so, apparently so, or actually. But either way, God trumps, whether it's the actual or apparent. God is always able to do more than the evil one, just by course nature of who he is. And I believe God puts a lid on it. He limits what can happen. And of course, God's power is not to be compared with the devil's. God's is infinite. The devil's is finite, whatever that may be.
Right. It seems to me that one of the basic claims that is made throughout the Bible is that God alone has the power of life and death, that God is the one who can raise the dead. I don't see anything in the Bible about demons being able to raise people from the dead. Perhaps they're able to stage a fake resurrection here or there, but I don't think they can actually raise people from the dead. So that would seem to be one example of something that God, and of course Jesus Christ, who was God incarnate on the earth, was able to do, and that demons are not able to do.
Well, Rod, that's a great point. There's at least two, and qualitatively, that I believe God alone can do, and that's one of them, is raising the dead. Someone might be able to give someone a drug. There were allegedly Hindu yogis and others who can so slow their breathing and whatnot that they appear to be dead and whatnot, but in fact they're not. So I think you're absolutely on the money there. The second one is, well, I think in some sense the demonic realm can predict the future. Only God can do it with 100% accuracy. That's another hallmark of God alone. Very clear, he says that numerous passages between Isaiah 42 and 48, that he alone is able to predict the future with absolute accuracy.
There's also biblical statements that God alone knows the hearts of all people.
Yes.
And I think it's important. Many people want to know, can the devil read my mind? Does he know what I'm thinking? And this is what I tell people. You tell me if you think this is accurate. Well, if he's watching you, he can probably guess what you're up to, but he doesn't know your heart and mind in the way that God does.
Yeah, I think you have to go that way. And think of it. You're dealing with an individual of incredible intelligence, maniacal, a sociopath, psychopath, whatever term you want to use, to be sure. But think of criminal minds, even today, who are often, some, not always, but I mean, there are some who are geniuses, clearly, in a deranged sense, and they use it in a diabolical sense. But they clearly have keen intellectual abilities. The devil obviously possesses those. He's been around a long time. He doesn't have to sleep. I would argue he's the master psychologist. And so I think just from years of watching human beings and watching individuals, absolutely, I think he can make fairly accurate predictions. Again, not with 100% certainty, not down to the nth degree, but in the ballpark, absolutely, because of his abilities and experience in studying humans in particular and general.
So, in other words, people need to be aware that Satan is active, and he does have considerable powers, but he's still just a creature. He's still finite. He's still limited. And as you pointed out with the book of Job, but he's basically on a leash in that he's not able to do something if God doesn't permit it.
Yes, two points there, Rob, absolutely. Number one, the devil, as in Job, God asked him, where have you been? Well, he knows. He's, for our benefit, he's been prowling around, going to and fro. We see the same thing in Peter as well, that he seeks whom he may devour. And so there is a caution. The Christian believer is to have a caution. We're not to be silly with our opponent. On the other hand, as Luther rightly said, the devil is God's devil. I think of it as a vicious pit bull or a Rottweiler on a big chain. and if you will, God actually holds the chain. And as long as you stay out of the circumference of where the dog's allowed to roam, you're fine. If you're foolish enough to venture in that area, you're asking for trouble. But the believer is protected by God, and the devil is, although he's a powerful being, much more than humans, he's nonetheless no match for God. And as we listen to God and obey him and don't mess around in the kingdom of the occult, we're fine.
And, of course, when you talk about God's protection over the believer, in this context, you're really focusing specifically on spiritual protection. There's no guarantee for the believer that they're going to be free from physical injury or harm or even death. Christians died at Katrina. Christians experience all kinds of physical suffering, whether it's from natural disasters or persecution. But through it all, when the devil is trying to tempt them to give up on God and to lose faith and lose heart and lose hope, God promises spiritual protection over believers who cling to him, who trust in him.
Absolutely. And of course, a lot of what you described, often called natural evil or physical evil, really has to do with the fall, not so much the devil per se, except as he's related to the fall.
Right.
And that would be one issue. But absolutely, as James says, submit yourself unto God, as you rank under, as you submit, as you stay close to God, resist the devil, he'll flee from you. And so that's absolutely the case. Or 1 John, greater is he that is in you than he that is in the world. That's the heritage of the believer.
I'd like to back up a little bit. When you were defining the occult, you used a couple of terms, and one of them may be only vaguely familiar to many people, and that's the term divination. Could you define divination and give us some examples so we kind of have a feel for what it includes?
Yeah, I like to give connotative and denotative definitions, Rob. Connotative, of course, are the criteria or things, the aspects of what constitutes something, and denotative is an example. So connotatively speaking, we'd say divination is the attempt to know things about the past, present, or future, any one of those categories, via occultic means and methods. In other words, it's not when I want to know about the stock market, I go to E.F. Hutton or some well-known brokerage or financial house, if you will, but I get out my so-called crystal ball, or I use an astrologer, or palmistry, or something of that nature. So divination is the attempt to know things, but again, through occultic means and method. And divination, there are literally hundreds of types. If I started reading a list now, we would spend the next couple hours just reading a list, but it's things like astrology. Iridology would be an example of that. Palm reading, tarot card reading, rune stones, and all kinds of things. Classically, it was everything from animal entrails and arrows and the flights of birds and clouds to you name it. So those are some of the major categories of divination.
It's interesting you mentioned astrology as an example. Maybe you could elaborate on that. Why is astrology considered divination?
Yeah, and of course by astrology, we don't mean astronomy. Astronomy is a legitimate science, or certainly can be, which is the scientific study of what we would call heavenly bodies of the universe. Astrology, on the other hand, is an artificial system that 12 signs that are superimposed upon the heavens, allegedly have 12 houses, and then astrology is based upon the idea that depending on which house one is born in, then you can know all these things about a person and the date they're born and so forth. And there are just numerous problems with astrology, both scientifically and biblically. But it is a form of divination because there's, number one, there's no scientific basis for it. And number two, it really is just really taking a system and imposing it upon the heavens that is irrelevant to it and really has to do with an occultic philosophy or worldview behind it that really makes it operate.
And the other term that you used, and actually there were two words that if I understood, basically more or less synonymous terms, and that those would be magic and sorcery.
Yeah.
Could you explain what those words mean and maybe some examples of those?
Yeah, and really there are different Greek and Hebrew terms for sorcery and sorcerers or sorceresses, the female variety, and for magic. But what we mean by this, and maybe I'll start with magic, that will help as we use them as synonyms. Here, I don't mean prestidigitation. I don't mean sleight of hand. I'm not talking about the Amazing Randi or Andre Cole, who's actually a Christian, and the latter is at least, where they're fancy tricks, Rob, whether they're clumsily done or cleverly, from pulling a rabbit out of their hat or allegedly ripping up a dollar bill and putting it back together. They're tricks to the trade, and of course that's how they make a living, but if they wanted to, they could stop and show you how it's done. But via misdirection and a number of tools of the trade, they're able to fool you, to give you an optical illusion that they can do something that they really can't do. We're not talking about that. We're not saying, don't have that guy come to your kid's birthday party or something like that. What we're talking about, and often what helps, is if we say that magic is often spelled with a K. In this sense, magic, as with sorcery, is the idea that through incantations, through spells, through the use of certain drugs, sometimes in combination with this, or potions, that one can manipulate or bend or twist morality to get what they want. So, for example, instead of working hard to get that new car that I want, I believe I have a spell that if I use it will simply cause this car to somehow be given to me or arrive at arrive at me. A candy bar and a machine, instead of putting money in it or even not shaking the machine, I have a spell that's going to give me that Snickers bar. And so people often do this, everything from so-called finding a soulmate to getting someone to fall in love with them, to bring them success or prosperity. And again, key idea here is it's often done via a spell or what are called words of power, words that are spoken in a spell with a certain way, with a certain emotional emphasis and then certain other aspects put into it. This will cause you to be able to bend or twist or manipulate reality, for example, people, get them to do things you want them to do that they wouldn't otherwise do.
Well, that's very helpful. Now let's talk about the whole idea of witchcraft and witches and warlocks, and also this term that is very popular today that apparently is more or less synonymous with witchcraft, and that's Wicca. Could you explain what these terms mean? Is there any distinction in the usage of the terms witch and witchcraft and Wicca and kind of what those really are?
Yeah, it is. It gets a little complicated only because you have to understand, people need to know that witches pride themselves, the contemporary movement, on being very eclectic, very experience-oriented. They really abhor things like codification, trying to classify them and their views, beliefs, and practices. And so they're very free-flowing, and it's really hard. It's like literally trying to stick Jell-O to a wall sometimes. But there's three ways to understand this, in essence. Many witches, those who really got into it, let's say from the 70s and 80s and so forth, and even the earlier 90s, they would often use the term witchcraft, or excuse me, witch, and Wiccan as synonymous. One was a witch or a Wiccan, and they liked both terms. However, there is actually a tradition, point number two, of witchcraft called Wicca. So it's one branch or type, or do they call it tradition of Wicca? And this would be opposed to a school, for example, like Alexandrian or Gardnerian. These are types of witchcraft. They have a lot in common, and they have just a few minor differences. Third point is, however, since the mid to late 90s and since the 21st century, there is a group of people who sprung up who consider themselves Wiccan but not witches. And so basically there's three categories, and now here's how to simplify it. Just ask the person, do you claim to be a Wiccan or a witch and or a witch, and if so, how are you using the terms? That's all you have to do is just stop and ask them, and they'll tell you. But it's kind of ironic, Rob, and a group that's prided themselves on being anti-creedal, experience-oriented, many more traditional witches are really getting frustrated with the people who call themselves Wiccans but not witches, and then deny some of the key aspects of witchcraft. It's kind of funny to see the thing turn on its head.
Right. Well, I'm going to ask you a question, and I feel a little silly or embarrassed even asking it, but I'm going to ask this anyway because there's got to be people who are listening who have this question in their minds. And maybe it's a two-part question. Part one is, how is this tradition of witchcraft / Wicca that has emerged and become so robust in the last 30, 40 years, how does this compare with or relate to historically what was called witchcraft in centuries past? The situations in the 17th and 18th centuries when there were witch scares in Salem and so forth. So how does it compare or relate historically to those? And then my part two of my question is, does witchcraft really have anything to do with people flying on brooms and doing the kinds of things that our stereotypical cultural icons of witchcraft would suggest?
Mm-hmm. Actually, those are very good questions. It really, contemporary witchcraft, and by that I mean since the 50s, it really appears that Gerald Gardner and a few other people really invented modern and then now contemporary witchcraft. There was a few key players early on, and Gerald Gardner would probably be the individual, and then a gal who worked with him. But what they did have in common, let's start with that, with so-called 16th, 17th, 18th century type stuff. The only thing they had in common was that some of them actually practiced forms of the occult. Again, divination, magic, spiritism, sorcery. That's what they had in common. the ones that actually did do this and weren't just unjustly accused as such.
Right.
They were using potions, herbs, and whatnot to do the spells, incantations, and all that. That's about the only thing they had in common. We would call it an occultic worldview. Their beliefs were quite different. Let me make one more point here, Rob. Even as you read your King James Version Bible, and it'll talk about witchcraft, that's not a bad translation for the time, but today it doesn't have the same meaning. What those Hebrew terms and Greek terms will mean that are used when the word witchcraft is used in the King James Version really refer to forms or types of occultists and occultism. Again, the kingdom of the occult is a big network. It's a big family, if you will, of beliefs and practices related to each other. So even going back a little further to the King James Version Bible, so witchcraft it's not the contemporary stuff being practiced, but what they do have in common is they're all still involved in divination, magic / sorcery, and spiritism. Now, so that's the only things they really had in common, and in that sense it's accurate to talk about witchcraft. However, today witchcraft is one type of the occult. It's one category. And then again, there are divisions or traditions or types within witchcraft. But let's deal with some stereotypes you asked about. The idea of the witches, I mean, generally it's that they're ugly old hags, or only females, and they have these big conical-shaped hats and black regalia and fly around on brooms and that stuff. Now, obviously, that's mythology, fictitious. It does appear that the tradition of witches flying comes from their use of belladonna and other hallucinogenics that gave them the sensation that they were flying or having out-of-body experiences. That's where the core of this probably comes from. But, of course, those are the idea of them being ugly, unsuccessful, loners, social outcasts are just radical stereotypes. Many of them are very intelligent, well-educated, attractive. They're really like John and Joan Q Public or Americana today. They can be computer scientists, teachers, you know, whatever, law enforcement, all types of things. But the idea of brooms is really... Well, they do use brooms and that, but not to fly on. They'll use them, for example, in a wedding ceremony called hand fasting. They jump over the broomstick, if you will, and they use it in a house cleaning ceremony and that. But it's not in the sense of flying around. Other stereotypes, Rob, I'm sure you probably have in mind, is that they eat babies and they kill animals and probably people as well, and particularly babies and so forth. And whatever witches are involved or not involved in, they're not involved in human sacrifice because they believe all life is sacred. And so they tend to be, and here's some more terms, sorry, pantheists, panentheists, and or polytheists. They tend to believe all life is sacred, part of the divine, a continuum of the divine. So they don't want to be involved in killing it. They think that would be immoral. Also, most of them believe in some type of what's called the Wiccan Reed and the threefold law of return, that any evil or harm done to others, well, the Wiccan Reed goes like this. It's basically the basic Wiccan ethic, and ye harm none, or don't harm anybody, do whatever you want. Now, we'd have to come back to what they mean by harm and so forth, but and ye harm none, do what you will. And then the threefold law of return is the idea that any harm done to someone else will come back to you at least three times as much. So if you did something to hurt somebody, three times that amount is going to come back upon you. So for those two reasons and the idea that they believe life is sacred or divine, they're not involved in killing babies or animals and those type of stereotypes.
I think a similar question or similar stereotype is that of witches involved in doing things like putting hexes or curses on people. That's certainly a popular association with witchcraft, from centuries past. Is that something that has any connection with witchcraft or Wicca today?
Very little. There are some groups, I've heard witches say, and I have to chuckle, though no witch would throw a hex, throwing a hex. But there clearly are some that do. I have books, and I know some that they clearly do. But it's a minority view. Again, they're not involved in that, Rob, because of the reason we just mentioned. They think it's going to come back upon them three times. They believe life is sacred, and the idea is you're violating the Wiccan Reed. Really, what I think people have in mind are other forms of the occultists. Again, what often happens is that witches and witchcraft is conflated with other forms of occultism. It's confused with other forms. And there are other occultists who psychics, so it was the euphemism for mediumship and all that, who would do things like that. But which is generally, I mean, as a general rule, stay away from that type of thing, doing hexes.
All right, now I'm going to do something that's terribly unfair to you, and I'm going to ask you to comment on something I didn't warn you ahead of time, and that is, because I know people listening and saying, well, you're talking about witchcraft, so you have to address this, and that is the entire Harry Potter phenomenon. You know, do the Harry Potter books describe something that has any relationship to witchcraft? Is it only a very minor tangential relationship? You know, is there stuff in Harry Potter that's definitely occultic that people should know about and be discerning about? Could you give us some perspective on that?
Yeah, that's really thrown me into the lion's den, Ron. But you didn't tell me. It's that, as you know, it's really controversial.
Yes.
There are Christians who are basically saying it's really Christian, whether she knows it or not. And some seem to be even implying she really is a Christian deep down, at least. And it's kind of in the genre of C.S. Lewis and the Chronicles of Narnia and
Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. And on the other hand, there's those who, you know, swear it's from the devil himself and, you know, pumping it right through her. And then of course, there's in-between views. I take this view. I'm concerned that minimally that parents beware, particularly because a lot of younger people are reading it, older ones to be sure, but younger ones. And the problem I have is that, you know, the hero, I mean, Harry Potter, the protagonist, I mean, he lies, he steals, he does a lot of things that are just immoral. And he's clearly involved in forms of the occult. Again, big time, of course, divination, magic, / sorcery, and spiritism are just really rampant in the movies and the book. So my concern is, therefore, am I saying, therefore, a Christian could never read it? I'm not saying that. But I'm saying beware, be wise. I couldn't let my children read it in good conscience unless I'd, at best, unless I'd really instructed them about what's going on and worked them with them through the book. Because here's my concern. Because it glamorizes evil at some points, just lying and stealing and so forth. But also it glamorizes, at worst, the occult. The things, Rob, there are passages in the Bible that I blush when I read them. They're so strong. I believe God is a gracious and merciful God. He is also holy. But when he judges, his harshest judgments have come down on people involved in the occult. And so I can't take that lightly. And furthermore, I believe at best it tends to desensitize people to evil. It makes light of it. It desensitizes it. It makes it funny, cute, what have you. And so, oh, it's not that bad. And that's my concern, is this type of literature, this genre of literature, desensitizes people to the radical evil of the occult and the real source of it, and makes light of it. It makes it very entertaining and so forth.
Right.
So I'm not necessarily saying therefore Christians should never read it, but I'm saying that at least at best if you do, beware. And Rob, one more point here, and this is here's a factual statement. A lot of these things we can debate. There's some subjective judgment, but let's take Llewellyn. Llewellyn out of Minnesota is one of the largest, if not the largest, occult publisher in the world. Rob, this one publisher publishes more books in a year than even I can keep up with reading, and so, as someone who specializes in this. And they've noted since the Harry Potter series, since the series of books and then, of course, the movies, a radical spike in increase in the sales of their books, their occultic books on witchcraft and related items since the Harry Potter series. Now, at least they have attributed directly to the Harry Potter series. So one of the things we do need to note, I believe, and I think there is a relationship here. I don't think they've committed a causal fallacy. I haven't gone into all their evidence. But I think they're right that there is a causal connection between the Harry Potter series and an increased interest in the occult. And so I've got to warn Christians at least of that.
I think it's worth pointing out that there's no reason to draw such a correlation or see any kind of similar causal effect after a film of the past, like you know, The Wizard of Oz. You know,
yes, yes.
That, you know, even though it has witches in it, you don't see that kind of serious mix of sort of fable and silliness entertainment with a very serious occultic themes that you do find in the Harry Potter films and books.
Yes, and that's my concern. So I would encourage people to read both sides. There are a number of authors. Richard Bonus would be the side that would definitely take, you know, a much harsher view, stronger view against the Harry Potter series. Marcia Montenegro, her material as well, and then read some of the other sides in that and come to a considered opinion based upon the Word of God. But minimally, I believe in worldview awareness, that people ought to be aware of. Here's an example, Rob. Can I use an analogy? Star Wars. I love the series. I enjoy it. But it has occultism smacked all the way through it, and when you talk to when the you know the maker of the series has been interviewed, he's very clear that he was influenced by Buddhism, and that he has this type of dualistic theme running right through it. The idea of the power with the yin and yang, the both good and evil of from the one source. That's standard Eastern occultism. That occultism is shot all the way through Star Wars. It doesn't mean I don't watch it. It doesn't mean I won't let my kids watch it. But it does mean I make them aware, and I'm aware of what's going on underneath it, so that I'm not deceived or others are not confused about a theme that runs through the series.
In fact, being familiar with these very popular forms of entertainment, these very popular films and books that have so influenced our culture and expressed these ideas, if Christians become familiar with them, they can help people understand what the theological, religious, and spiritual values and issues are. So, absolutely. In a sense, and when I'm talking about older Christian teens or adults, we're not talking about asking a 6-year-old to try to figure all this out. But I think it is something where if Christians are familiar with those things, rather than saying, "Oh, I've done a really terrible thing. I watched Star Wars or I watched a Harry Potter film." What can we learn from this about what needs to be avoided and what needs to be discerned and make these kinds of important distinctions?
Yeah. I never want somebody to defile their conscience. I believe we need to be sensitive to our conscience in light of the Word of God. And so I don't try to convince people if they're just adamantly, vehemently opposed.
Right.
For those who are on the fence or trying to think through the issue and or otherwise, I'm more in line with what you just said. I see these as cultural barometers. They're a way to measure the spiritual health or unhealthiness, if you will, in this case, of our society. And I see them as opportunities to share the gospel. Too often, Christians are known by what we don't do, by what we're not into. And I look at it as, sure, we have things that we feel are off limits. But on the other hand, I try to use these type of things and other current events as to understand the culture and where it is. What is it imbibing? If these movies are blockbusters, that means a lot of people are seeing them and liking them. And I also try to use them as opportunities to share the gospel. And I talk to somebody, let's say, who, Star Wars has been out for quite a while, obviously, and is a little passe in one sense. But some won't be upset, of course, me saying that. But at any rate, getting beyond that point. But I would use it as, and I have, is, well, what do you think about that? What do you like about it? What do you think about this theme? I try to tease out, I try to draw out of them what they like. And then I try to say, did you notice this? And I draw it to their attention. And then I see if they're interested and if I can use that as an opportunity to share the gospel. And I do that with all types of movies and books and the events. I don't just say, I don't do that, I don't see that, I don't watch that. And there are some things that are off limit for me and my family. There's some things I won't watch,
sure.
Even though I could say, oh, well, I need to know just so I can talk about it intelligently. There's certain movies I wouldn't go see that has gratuitous violence or sexuality or profanity in it. But there's much that I will watch or see. And again, I won't filter to my 5-year-old, but when the time comes when they're older, as is age appropriate and spiritually appropriate. Yeah, Rob, I see these as understanding our culture and being able to relate and share the gospel with them. And I see that it's vital that we're at least in touch and understanding where our society, collectively and individually, is coming from, so that we can relate. Luther said this. Interrupt myself here. Luther said, unless we've preached the gospel with contemporary relevance, we've not preached it. So it doesn't mean we compromise. It doesn't mean we shade our views or try to present them in a manner that's disingenuous or not really honest. But I try to apply the gospel to the part of the scripture that where people are today. And I try to understand them and see them and be a spectator and observer of culture, like a sociologist, only in a different sense, for a different reason, I should say, so that I can impact them effectively, hopefully, with the gospel of Jesus Christ.
Let me ask you about something in relation to some of these entertaining blockbuster films like Star Wars, and I think there's been other examples. When we talk about the unusual or paranormal or mystical experiences that or themes that lace a lot of these films. I wonder how much of it in our culture is really sort of fantasy kind of window dressing for humanistic themes. In other words, when in Star Wars, when Luke is taught that he has to believe that he can do these things, even though they seem fantastic, that this is not George Lucas telling American youth, you need to learn how to levitate things, but rather you need to learn to believe in yourself, you need to learn to be positive and have purpose and intention and make up your mind that you're going to do something and carry through. In other words, I'm wondering how much, and not just Star Wars, but in a lot of American film, fantasy film, it seems like these fantastic, mystical, even occult themes are often just vehicles for a kind of modern form of humanism that says you need to believe in yourself, you can do anything if you put your mind to it, in terms of being a successful person. And if that's the case, then, you know, are people being sort of, as you put it, desensitized to the occult, who may not even, you know, the people putting this out may not even realize that that's what they're doing?
Well, sure, and there we go. And there's two big tracks in this, boy, Rob. There's a lot of to work off what you just talked about there. I think that one is, yeah, it is some of that. I think, and I don't want to read too much into it, but I'm still concerned about that. And not that people have a PMA, a positive mental attitude or whatever, but the idea that you can do anything. I mean, it's a half-truth. Certainly if you don't try to do something, you're not going to accomplish it. But just because I believe I can do it doesn't mean I can.
That's right.
I can think I can leap tall buildings in a single bound. I just hope your insurance is paid up and you have a big bottle of Excedrin. So that's one issue. A secondary issue, though, and another problem is you do have part of the New Age movement, I know as you're well aware of, which is another category of the occult. Again, same thing. They're into divination, magic, spiritism, and sorcery. But with a different bend, if you will, some differing views in some sense, still the idea that all is divine or potentially so. But the human potential movement being a category of that, and the idea, again, that since we're divine, we can do anything. And there's at least four grades of that. I'm not saying everything that's positive and tells you to be encouraged is, therefore, you know, human potential or occultic, but some of it clearly is, and some of it just simply is not sound counsel. We can come back to that if you want. So I think you're right, but then there is a third category. There is a category that really is occultic. Look at the I'll switch gears for a moment. Look at the series The Matrix. The makers of those films, the three films in that series, are clearly coming from an occultic worldview and have said such. And they're clearly coming from, and it's a slash of various views. They're influenced by Nietzsche, the German philosopher, father of the patron saint of postmodernism, and clearly of some forms of Buddhism and Gnosticism. So they're, the fanciful things they do isn't just believe in yourself and have a positive attitude. It really is. They are really trying to open up a door to the occult. Whereas with other ones, I think you're right. It may not be that. It is the window, fancy window dressing at that, to encourage people to believe in themselves and have dreams, dream dreams, and really excel in life.
Now, when we talk about this is all very helpful, and I think, you know, what we're seeing here is that you know, in our society, the lines are very blurred in terms of the cultural trends involving the occult, humanism, witchcraft, you know, people who are out and out overtly engaged in occultism, those who are sort of playing at it or perhaps using it as window dressing. And it's all very blurred in our society today, which makes it very important and very really crucial for Christians to be discerning when you can't, you know, you can't say, well, these people over here are doing the occult and nobody else is. It doesn't seem to be that clear cut anymore.
No, it really isn't. It is so chic today. I'm not sure what the end terms are, Rob. Maybe you can help me. But whatever they are, it's really seen as with it, his hip or whatever the terminology is. Look at Madonna. She's a classic example, and her her espousing practice and espousing of Kabbalah, of a Jewish form of occultism, ironically from our Jewish friends, and clearly condemned by the Bible, but in fact they think actually supported by the Bible in the most ironic terms. But Kabbalism is a classic example. I think of Sasha Cohen, for example, the well-known ice skater and champion, wearing the paraphernalia associated with Kabbalah and then using that as an opportunity to talk about people. You know, Rob, it may be another publicity stunt for Madonna, and it may be naive and just dabbling on the part of Sasha Cohen, but the reality is people look up to them, they see what they're doing and they ask, and they inquire and they get involved. And so there is this blurring because, and here's my concern to the point. The kingdom of the occult, where at one time it was on the periphery, at least of American culture, has become more and more mainstream. You have a lot of Christians who, right, wrong, or indifferent, get upset about Halloween, which is another issue. But they don't seem to see that it's really Halloween 365 days here in America. The kingdom of the occult has become so mainstream, from Katy College and certain Montessori schools to the hallowed halls of a graduate school and academia. The kingdom of the occult has become more and more mainstream. And because of the celebrities, I mean, C.S. Lewis certainly nailed that in his classic book, The Screwtape Letters. He talked about how celebrities can be the Pied Pipers to lead people down primrose paths, if you will. But also, again, because of something I mentioned earlier, the occult is often seen as a doorway to success, to power, to acceptance, to all the things people fantasize about and they want, and Hollywood, at least on film and the magazine, seems to exemplify, if you will, in a very shallow sense, a very superficial sense. But also, again, there's this idea of it's not supernatural. It's neutral. It's like electricity. It can be used for good or evil. It's really not supernatural. It's super normal. It's just above or beyond the normal. It's really super science. So quit being primitive. Quit being medieval. Get over your blinders, if you will, and see it as avant-garde and the wave of the future. Not only is it chic or hip or whatever term one wants to use, but it's also super science, and it's really the key to successful life and so much we want and we allegedly see as typified in the so-called Hollywood stars.
Now let's draw this to a close by focusing on the question of how we can effectively communicate to people who really are deeply involved and committed to the occult, people who are practicing Wiccans or neo-pagans is another term that we haven't actually defined but is very closely related to kind of movement. How can we share the gospel with people that are into the occult, who are practicing witches? What should we say? What should we avoid? What should we try to do? Could you give us some guidance in that area?
Yeah, a couple things, Rob. And there are a number of other related concepts, nature worship. I've mentioned pantheism, panentheism. We haven't even touched on reincarnation, which is another big issue that goes through almost all this material, or the related view of transmigration. But number one, it's a shameless plug here, but I do talk about these in both of my books. I do discuss these terms and what they mean and various forms of occultism. And I also do present, and I like to do that right now as well as time permits, some guidelines for sharing the gospel with the folks involved in the kingdom of the occult, whether it's witchcraft or Satanism or ritual magic or Druidism or whatever, just consider themselves psychics or palm readers or what have you. A couple things is, number one, we're not asking people to be experts on the occult. That's not what we're asking. We're asking Christians to be experts on Christianity, to be experts on Jesus Christ. And I would argue if you know the gospel, then you're going to know how to share with an individual who's involved in the occult. So I can imagine someone listening and thinking, this is just a bewildering variety, and I'm more confused now than ever. I hope that's not the case. But if it is, here's the good news. Number one, again, we're only asking that you become experts on Christianity. Know the gospel, know the genuine, know who Jesus is and how to, and then share him with others. Number two is ask them questions. You don't need to be an expert. Ask them. Don't assume. Well, what do you believe? And don't do it accusatory. Don't cop an attitude like, you don't believe that, do you? You're not one of those, are you? Because they'll generally resent that and or they'll tell you probably what you want to hear.
Sure.
So ask them, what are you practicing? What do you believe? What's your view on this? And ask them the big questions. Who's Jesus? But you got to define that way. What do you mean by Jesus? How is one saved? What's the purpose of life? And why have you been involved? Why are you involved in this form of witchcraft or Satanism? And ask them, what needs do you think it meets? What do you appreciate about it? And I have found generally, well, it's true of all people, generally their favorite topic, Rob, to be honest, is themselves. And if you ask people questions, they generally get a little bit disarmed, because a lot of witches in particular are defensive. They are expecting Christians to attack them, they think, and come after them and proselytize. And so I try to be sensitive to that, and I just ask them questions and do it through that avenue, and I often find they let their guard down and are willing to talk with me. Here's another stereotype to avoid. Now, the biblical view is that ultimately, all that energizes the occult is the demonic realm, is Satan the demonic. But that doesn't mean that people necessarily believe in the demonic, or at least believe in the devil. Many occultists today, at least many witches, don't even believe in a devil. They may believe in some malevolent beings, whether they call them demons or not, but, Rob, they don't believe in a devil. So my goal is not to try to prove to them that the devil exists. My goal really is to share the gospel with them, and that would come along the way. So I don't say, oh, you believe in the devil, don't you? Or you do these things. No, they're going to say, you know, you're another Christian nut. See, this is the problem. Well, we don't like to talk to you type of people, because you all have these stereotypes. So we just let them talk, let them tell us, and then share the things, I mean, the issues of how do they think they're going to be saved, let them tell you their view of salvation, and then, as appropriate, share the gospel and share who Jesus really is. Remember that almost any of these occultic groups I could mention, and there's hundreds of them, they all claim Jesus in some way, shape, and form. The Hindu thinks Jesus is some form of avatar. The Buddhists think he's some form of Buddha. The witches think he is literally was a witch. The ritual magician thinks he was a master magician or an adept. So define your terms and just lovingly present the gospel. Share, interact with them. Look for gospel bridges, if we can call it that. And I think you'll be pleasantly surprised. One thing that might help as well, I have some handouts that I can make available for you to people, Rob. I have like the occult family tree, and I break down general categories of the occult. I have what are called theories of the occult. There's different philosophies of how the occult works, and it gets kind of complicated. And then, but then I have some basic verses that also from the Old and New Testament talk about why we're not to be involved in the occult. And those are readily available. I can list some of those, but I try to mention three things to people. I mean, the Bible does take a very dim and very harsh view of the occult, magic again, / sorcery, divination, and spiritism. But I also point out to people, look, I don't need divination. Within Jesus Christ are hid all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge, as we're told in Colossians. We're told if any of us lacks wisdom, we can ask of God. James tells us, again, the same thing, that God's no respecter of persons, but gives liberally to all. So why do I need to go to the occult? I can go to Jesus, and God will give me at least, not that he's going to tell me everything, but everything I need to know, God will give to me. So he's my wisdom. I can't control the world, and some people feel powerless, and they want some control. Some just want to manipulate others, but some just say, look, I have no control. But I'm told that our God, in Romans 8:28, works all things together for good to those who love him, who are called according to his purposes. I'm not in control, but we serve a God who is in control. So again, I don't need the occult and try to manipulate reality. And spiritism, I don't need to try to contact spirits and really, which I'm going to argue is a bunch of nonsense and or demonic. But I can talk to the true and living God who invites me to have fellowship and a relationship with him through Jesus Christ as my Savior. And God is there to guide me and direct me and give me, again, the counsel and the understanding that I need. So it's not just the occult is wrong, and it is. I don't mean to belittle that point. But I also try to point out I don't even need it. It's not true to begin with. And, in fact, your kids, you know this, Robin, raising children, you can't just say don't do this. Yes, you have to say that at times. No, you can't. Johnny, you can't run in the street. But it's also you give them the positive, and here's the good, and here's the reward of doing the right thing, and here's the blessings that come with doing wise things. And so I don't want to just try to be like I'm the scolding parent. I also want to be the positive in the good sense as well of sharing the great truths of the gospel. And there are wonderful truths of the gospel that relate to those who are involved in witchcraft and so forth. There's various approaches. For time's sake, we probably won't be able to get into those, but I talk about those in my books. I don't have just one approach. I believe there's multiple approaches, and I try to utilize the one that I think, after praying to God for wisdom, that will be the most appropriate for the individual and type of occultist that I'm talking to.
Well, this is very helpful. You know, it's very important that people understand that when they share the gospel with somebody who's involved in the occult, they're not just asking them to give up something, they're asking them to put something in its place, which is a relationship with the living God. And you can't have more life-transforming and life-enhancing power than that, because he is the author of life.
Yes.
And so that's very important. And, you know, we're not talking about being able to see the exact same kinds of phenomena necessarily, or in fact, in most cases, not the same kind of phenomena that is pursued in the occult, but a different kind of phenomena, which is the transformation of a person from the inside out by the love of God in Jesus Christ. And that's a very powerful message for people who, you know, need it and are ready to receive that.
And absolutely. And one point I've got to mention here, Rob, is many occultists, whether a Wiccan or a witch, whatever term they use, or you know, Satanists or ritual magician, often have stereotypes of Christianity. It's just legalism, rules on that more abundantly. I love what you said. I think of Acts 3:15 when it says of Christ, he's the archegos in Greek. He's the source of life. It also says this of eternal life. It also says that in 1 John 1:2 and 5:20 and elsewhere. He is the source. He's the fount. He's the prince of life. He, as we're told in John 10:10, has come to give us life and that more abundantly. Many occultists have stereotypes. Christianity is a bunch of rules and regulations, and or it's a spectator religion. They feel like they're a middleman or something, that they're not really involved in the practices, and nothing could be further from the truth. And that's why we need to point out that it's a personal, dynamic relationship with God with no middleman. Yes, we have pastors and so forth, but they're as leaders to work with us and guide and direct us. They're not there to tell us everything, and they can't have a relationship with God for us. So it's very important to realize this. A lot of them really like their personal involvement, that they're important. They may be involved in a coven, a small group of 13 or less or slightly more, but they're a vital part of the group, and they're missed when they're not there. And we need to communicate that. The people are important, that Christ didn't just die for the masses. He died for individuals, and we need to treat them as such, especially since a lot of them, right, wrong, or indifferent, have these stereotypes of Christianity and sometimes have been involved in the church and have had some bad experiences, unfortunately. And we need to keep that in mind, that they might have often do have these stereotypes, and really put the emphasis upon Jesus and a personal relationship with him and the life and that more abundantly that he gives, and not just pie in the sky, but right now.
Well, that's very helpful. And Craig, let me remind people of the books that you've written on these subjects. You've written a book called Goddess Worship, Witchcraft, and Neo-Paganism that's published by Zondervan, and also a book called Witchcraft, Exploring the World of Wicca, and that's published by Baker Bookhouse. And folks, if you are interested in the ministry of Craig Hawkins, I encourage you to go to his website. That is apologeticsinfo, all one word, apologeticsinfo.org, and you can also go to hischannel.com, and you can listen to Living by the Word radio broadcast, which features Craig Hawkins as the host and deals with a variety of apologetics issues on a weekly basis. Craig, I really appreciate you taking time out of what I know is a very busy schedule to spend an hour with us. I really appreciate that.
Oh, Rob, my absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. You've been listening to 4truth.net.